Are the mics on now? They're good. I know I have a sinus infection, but I know my hearing is not that bad. If you are here for Senate File 2642, as well as Senate File 1678, those two bills have been pulled from the agenda. Just so that you can go home, because we don't have much time, and given the delayed nature of the committee meeting today, we will try to accommodate those two bills at a later date, and we'll let you all know in plenty of time. So go home. Enjoy the afternoon in the snow. We'll start with Senate File 2511, Senator Rest. Thank you for waiting for us all this time.
Maybe that's it.
Madam Chair and members, last year we circulated letters to all the state agencies that had advisory groups that worked with the state agencies, indicating at an efficiency move that we were going to repeal those that we did not hear back from the state agencies that they were actually working groups. We passed that bill, having heard from any number of agencies that the advisory groups or some informal groups that they had that nevertheless were in statute were necessary to their operations, and they were ongoing, et cetera, and we took those out of the bill. We did not hear, however, from two departments or agencies about advisory groups that they did indeed use on an ongoing basis. And they contacted us during the interim and asked for the repeal to be undone. And so I agreed to correct the mistake that they made. And so we have this bill, 2511, is simply reinstating the repealed groups that are indeed ongoing for the Racing Commission and for the Department of Corrections.
So this is just a technical correction on a mistake that was made last time around.
I mean,
any questions?
If we discovered it before the session ended, we would have put them back in the revisor's bill.
And the revisor's bill didn't get passed last session, so it's very good that we're doing this. Any questions for Senator Rest? Seeing none, Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 2511 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor to be put on the consent calendar. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Bach. Senate File 2379.
Madam Chair and committee members, when we did the eminent domain reform in 2006, we cleaned up some of the language in law relative to eminent domain, and one of the things that inadvertently happened was previously we had, the legislature had authorized up to $50,000 to be paid for relocation of existing businesses, and somehow in the process of cleaning up some language, we inadvertently eliminated that, and what ends up happening was we fall back under federal law, where federal, like on highway projects, where there's federal money that applies, and the reimbursement goes down to $10,000, which is what there is under federal law. So we've got a number of projects that have gone forward that the relocation benefit we've paid is not the higher $50,000 number that we always had paid, but because of the cleanup language, we're now only authorized to pay $10,000. So this just corrects something that we believe inadvertently happened in the 2006 bill.
Any questions for Senator Bach? Again, this is one of those situations where I think the law doesn't reflect what we actually wanted to do, and we're just making that correction. Ms. Parker is here if anybody has any questions. See none. Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 2379 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor and be put on the consent calendar. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is Senate File 624, which is a fairly low number, which means it's a bill from last year. And actually, this committee did hear and pass this bill last year, dealing with some just technical cleanups in the marriage license statute. After the bill passed this committee, it did have a fee increase for marriage licenses, and so the bill went to the Finance Committee. As you can see from the bill summary, subsequently, the language on the fee increase was actually adopted and passed as part of a separate bill. So that part is, even though it's technically still in the bill, we've got the A2 amendment, which ultimately will take those provisions out because they don't need to be dealt with. They're already in law right now. But let me review the bill as you have it before you, and then we do have an A2 amendment, which will just kind of clean up a little bit more language. Again, this is just more of a technical bill that deals with marriage licenses, and I'll just walk you through it very quickly. Section 1 is simply technical. We don't have court administrators doing this work anymore. It's local registrars. That's the proper term. That's all Section 1 of the bill does. Section 2, we do change the term court administrator, local registrar. Also, at the top of page 2, it does refer to the collection of a $20 filing fee that's to be collected by the person who is going to be registering. That is the person who's going to be administering or presiding over the marriages. There is no consistent fee in the state. Some counties charge nothing, as my notes from last year indicated. Some are zero up to $47. It's just all over the map. It's whatever. So a person who is going to preside over marriages in multiple counties just has to file once, but they may be paying, you know, different rates, and so the $20 fee was a seemed to be consistent. But as I say, if the committee has any further desire on that, we can certainly get into that. Section 3 deals with a unique situation where border counties, and so people who are going to be married in Minnesota have to obtain the marriage license from a registrar within the state of Minnesota rather than, and then the marriage, if they get the license here, then the marriage should, it may need not take place in the county where it's obtained, but it has to be within the geographical boundaries of the state of Minnesota. So our marriage licenses should be within Minnesota. Again, this is part of the bill that was in last year. In Section 4, we do have an amendment that's going to, most of this was just technical. It does delete the court administrator language that we missed last year, but the A2 amendment is going to be just clarifying on page line 12 that both parties must certify their names, their ages, and so forth, the information that's on it. It does refer to the Social Security number on lines 26 to 28, but that doesn't deal with the situation if a party does not have a Social Security number, and so the A2 amendment will deal with that situation that they have to certify that they don't have a Social Security number. And then on lines 33 and 34 of page 2, the party may not use a different surname, and actually we want to get anybody who's using a different name, period. It's not just the surname. As I say, most of these were very reviewed last year. On pages 3 and 4, sections 5 and 6 will be deleted by the A2 amendment because that was already enacted last year in the state government budget bill. On page 5, section 7, the current law requires that there has to be 3 marriage certificates. There's no reason to issue 3 and they're computerized. I mean, there used to be like a souvenir certificate that I guess you could frame or something. Nobody needs 3 certificates. You only need 1. And so this would eliminate the reason for 3 certificates. And then Section 8 is just consistent language where you don't want to, the person solemnizing marriage doesn't just deliver, you got to file the certificate with the local registrar. As I say, it was mostly a technical bill last year, Madam Chair, and this is what's left. Obviously, during the interim, the people who have an interest in the bill did go back and just review the language, and they found just some minor technical changes I've already kind of touched on, and that is the A2 amendment. So I'll move the A2 amendment Again, this is the second look that this committee's had of the bill.
Any questions to Senator Betzel on the A2 amendment?
Yes.
All those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. Motion carries.
And, Madam Chair, I do have a witness here who can also discuss this bill, again, if the members of the committee wish to go over any details here.
Do members of the committee have questions in particular that you have? Maybe I know that we had a very thorough discussion on the bill, and so I just want to give members an opportunity to ask questions if they had them. Otherwise, I don't think we need you to go through. I do have a question. We're issuing only one now. If somebody comes back and would like a copy of the marriage certificate, do they have to pay another fee to get a copy of the certificate?
Madam Chair, Cheryl Parrish, Todd County Recorder. And yes, they would pay a $9 fee that's already established in statute.
Very good. Any further questions for Ms. Parrish? Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 624, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
I believe so. I do note, of course, you know, at the very top of page 2, as I say, the big fiscal issues last year were the raising of the marriage fee to pay for itself because it had not been raised in a number of years. That has been done. It does require now a consistent $20 filing fee. It's not a state funding issue. It's just a consistent thing. I don't know that the Finance Committee has to see it. I mean, we'll send it to the floor. I think I'll just double-check with the Finance Committee to see if they really want to see it. They didn't get around to this bill last year, but I don't know that it's a Finance Committee issue, but I can double-check with them.
So. And I don't think we've gotten any communications on this bill from any other committees.
So I'll move to send it to the floor.
On Senator Betzel's motion to send Senate File 624 to the floor, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Parrish.
Thank you.
Senator Scheid, Senate File 2575. Don't we wish that the rest of this legislative session could go this well?
Today, and the first two in Senator Scheid's committee took a little more time. So,
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'm, excuse me, Senate File 2575 is a bill supported by the State Bar Association. Article 1 has technical amendments to the Business Corporations Act, and these gentlemen will go through those things, excuse me, when I'm done, but Article 2 contains technical amendments to the Limited Liability Company Act and the Uniform Limited Partnership Act of 2001. Article 3 permits formation of nonprofit limited liability companies. I don't know who's going to say what. Did you want me to run through? I did read everything you said, and I think the members have also their comments here. There is an amendment, however, that we should probably deal with right away, and that is, if you look on page 2 of this handout that's titled Executive Summary, on the second page of that, it shows two sections in Article 1 and two sections in Article 2 that need to be stricken because they apparently have some fiscal implication. Secretary of State's office notified us that they had concerns, so we just want to take those out. It has to do with names. In fact, so I'd...
Senator Scheid, hang on a second. Does everybody have the summary in the back?
Article 1, Section 6 and 7, is that what you're saying? Maybe an article?
I can tell you the page numbers if you of those sections. I've noted that here.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
So, Senator Scheid, you're saying that we should be deleting Article 1, Sections 6 and 7, and Article 2, Sections 4 and 5?
Yes. Just those two sections from each of those articles. The section six, Madam Chair, is on page 7, 8, and 9. Section 7 appears on page 9. That's a small section. That's section 6 has, I think, a page that has no new language in it, but it's
Article
7, 8, 9. Then in Article 2, section 4 appears on page 17, 18, and 19. And section 5 of Article 2 is on page 19.
Ending at line 19.25?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Leaving in section 6, right? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Do you have that, Council? All right. So on Senator Scheid's amendment to put the bill in the shape that she would like it to be in, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now I think, Mr. Klein, are you?
Mr.
Knorr is going to speak first.
Is it Knorr?
Madam Chair, it is Knorr.
I asked him the same question, Madam Chair.
Well, Mr. Knorr, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Knorr. I'm the legislative coordinator for the business law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association and have been working with our section to get this legislation in front of you.
Madam Chair, excuse me.
Senator Higgins.
Could you pull that microphone up close to you?
Madam Chair, is that better?
It would almost have to be right where your tie is.
There you go.
Yes.
Is that better, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah.
Perfect. There are three articles to our amendments. We have at the business law section standing committees for the Business Corporation Act, the Limited Liability Company Act, and other acts, and they, throughout the course of practice, get comments from practitioners about inconsistencies in the statute, ambiguities in the statutes, and so they collect these and work them into draft bills periodically. What's before you is largely the result of that process. And I'm happy to go through each point or take questions, whatever your preference would be, Madam Chair.
Mr. Knorr, I think that you should walk us through the bill so that the members have a chance to learn what the different changes are.
Very good. The Article 1, we've clarified how and when notice may be given under the Minnesota Business Corporation Act. And what we have done is added a provision that says if you deliver something to one of these nationally recognized overnight delivery services such as FedEx, that will be deemed notice when delivered there and not when received by the individual as long as you have made appropriate payment for that. So that's the nature of that change.
I'm sorry. In that,
Senator Parasol?
Madam Chair, that relates to what kinds of business?
Mr. Knorr?
Is it purchase business or is it board membership, did you say, or board notification?
Madam Chair and Senator, this is in connection with notices that need to be given under to shareholders in connection with shareholder meetings, to board of director members in connection with board meetings, notices like that.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Section 2 of Article 1 simply makes a clarification to recognize that the NASDAQ stock market is now deemed to be an exchange and not an automated quotation system, a very technical change that just sort of reflects what's happened. Section 3 provides some clarifying language. The statute provides a list of items that may only be modified in the articles of incorporation of a company, so that is the document that is on public record. Or we've added a provision that says you can also modify these in a shareholder control agreement, the idea being in order for it to be effective, all of the shareholders have to sign that shareholder control agreement. And so we've tried to build in a little bit more flexibility into the statute. Section 4 is a very similar provision. It lists things that may be modified in the articles or the bylaws of a corporation. And again, we've simply provided some greater flexibility to say you can also modify these things if all the shareholders agree in a shareholder control agreement. Yeah, and Section 5 ties into that and just provides clarity that, you know, our intent is not to limit the scope of what you can do in a shareholder control agreement, but rather just to provide the flexibility. Section 6 is one of the sections that has been deleted, as has Section 7. Sections 8 and 9 are very technical changes just to make clear that if you participate in a meeting by telephone, for example, that constitutes presence in person at the meeting because the reference to in person shows up in other places in the statute, and so we wanted to make it crystal clear that this qualified. Section 10 is a provision that as the statute stands now, there's a presumption that each director has one vote in a Minnesota corporation. The new provision here in Section 10 would permit a corporation to allocate voting rights differently among directors, and that would have to be done either in the articles of incorporation, so at the inception of the corporation, or it would require unanimous written agreement of all of the shareholders to make that modification. And the intent is to build in, again, greater flexibility, and this provision is modeled after the Delaware provision. Section 11 is a technical amendment intended to clarify, to resolve an ambiguity. As originally drafted, when it simply referenced the board, if there were vacancies on the board, it would complicate the analysis of how you calculate the board vote. And so we've provided that you need a vote of the majority of the directors currently holding office so that you take away that ambiguity and you don't have to worry about vacancies. And Section 12 is the same change, just to a different statutory section. Section 13 clarifies when a party can revoke a proxy that they have given to vote, and it clarifies that it may be done by electronic transmission. Section 14 are some similar changes to properly reference the NASDAQ markets as they are currently constituted. Section 15 is a revision to the definition of special legal counsel. The Minnesota statute sets out a series of parties that get to make decisions as to whether an officer or director of a Minnesota corporation is entitled to indemnification under the statute. And generally that would be, a majority of the disinterested directors, but it's possible that they are all interested or they have all been sued and are all seeking indemnification. And so the statute permits the board, even though they are not disinterested necessarily, to appoint special legal counsel to make a determination as to whether indemnification is proper or not. And as drafted, the special legal counsel could never have represented that corporation, its directors, officers, members, or committees ever in the past. And so we took a look at the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation, which provides that audit partners at the public accounting firms have to rotate off being the audit partner for public companies in a five-year period is the look back there. So we adopted that five-year period here and said, if you have not represented the company for the last 5 years, then you're as independent as any other special legal counsel out there might be. And then this language also provides that if the only capacity your representation has taken is special legal counsel, there isn't even the five-year disqualification period. Section 16 was a typo that was fixed. Section 17 just provides a little clarification for the dissolution method and points parties to the proper statutory section, depending on whether shares have been issued or not. Section 18 simply clarifies the dissolution process again, after shares have been issued, how you would go through the dissolution process. It's simply a clarification. Article 2 is an analog to Article 1 with respect to the Limited Liability Company Act. So our LLC Act is structured like our corporate act, and so we try to make conforming changes where possible. And the changes in Article 2 are based upon the changes we just walked through in Article 1. Article 3 is the article that's the purpose of this article is to permit, and that's on, Madam Chair, page 24.
Thank you.
Is to permit the formation of nonprofit limited liability companies in the state of Minnesota. As drafted, our statutes do not permit nonprofit LLCs to be formed here. And so we have modified the language so that LLCs may be formed for any lawful purpose as opposed to any business purpose. When it's business, it can't be a nonprofit entity. And this bill also then requires foreign nonprofits that are operating in Minnesota to actually register with the Secretary of State's office. And it imports from the Minnesota Nonprofit Corporation Act the operational restrictions and the ownership restrictions that govern nonprofit corporations in Minnesota right now. So the intent is to make a nonprofit LLC be governed by the same limitations and restrictions that a nonprofit corporation in Minnesota currently is. And it also makes clear that the Attorney General would have the same level of oversight over a nonprofit LLC as that office does over nonprofit corporations currently.
Why would a nonprofit want to be have an LLC status?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Klein.
My name is Bill Klein. I am with the Gray Plant Moody Law Office in Minneapolis, and I'm the chair of the Partnerships and LLCs Committee of the Business Section of the Bar. You will often see organizations that are organized as nonprofit corporations, such as healthcare systems and the like. They may wish to operate a division or some sort of operation through an entity that creates a liability shield, much as many for-profit corporations or businesses can do through a separate limited liability company. But they cannot do that under Minnesota law right now. What they do, if they have adequate counsel, is they will form a Delaware limited liability company for that activity and then operate it that way. You may sometimes also have nonprofit entities that would like to form a joint venture to do something in furtherance of their nonprofit and exempt purposes. And for them to do that, they cannot do it under a Minnesota limited liability company without it being formed for business, which the IRS concludes is not consistent with their exempt purposes under Section 501(c)(3).
So, Mr. Klein, what are the tax implications for the LLC entity that is formed by this nonprofit?
Madam Chair, if the limited liability company is formed and is a nonprofit limited liability company, the entity can incorporate into its articles and bylaws provisions that are consistent with 501(c)(3) status, and that entity will then be viewed, income tax purposes, it will be viewed as a disregarded entity. Its income and loss will go into its owning nonprofit corporations, income and loss for federal tax purposes, but it will then be operating under an organization that the IRS will recognize as being consistent with its nonprofit purpose. If it formed a Minnesota limited liability company right now to do those activities, the IRS could come in and argue that that income, even though it flows through to the parent nonprofit corporation, might be taxable because it is being earned under an organization that does not meet the 501c3 requirements that the IRS has established.
And Mr. Klein, the rationale here is that if any profit or income earned from the LLC activities flows back to the parent nonprofit, that it goes to serve the underlying purpose of the nonprofit, as opposed to it being somehow income as an asset, as if it's a separate LLC?
Well, Madam Chair, under the provision as has been presented, the income that's generated by the nonprofit limited liability company would be subject to the same types of restrictions as income generated by a subsidiary nonprofit corporation. So for state law purposes, it would be income of the LLC, but it would be limited by the restrictions on what it could be used for. It could be distributed back to the nonprofit parent because it can make distributions to other nonprofit entities. But it would be the same restrictions that would apply in the case of a nonprofit corporation.
So, Mr. Klein, under current law, when some of our nonprofits establish a Delaware LLC for this purpose, is that how the income is treated?
Madam Chair, for income tax purposes, it will be the same because it's a single-member limited liability company, and under federal income tax laws, those are considered disregarded entities, and the owner is treated as generating that income. And so that's where nonprofits go right now to form. If they do form that, I would also point out that under Minnesota law, if a Minnesota nonprofit corporation formed a single-member Delaware limited liability company, under the Minnesota Limited Liability Company now, that limited liability company could not register. Not only would it not be required to register, but it could not register as a Minnesota, as a foreign limited liability company in Minnesota, because the definition of a foreign limited liability company in the Act is a limited liability company formed for profit.
Hmm. Well, Senator Scheid, I know we're not the tax committee, but I was a little bit concerned about this. And so I don't know if you've, you know, heard from any of the tax individuals, but...
Madam Chair, I have not. It would be helpful, Mr. Klein, if you have an example. I mean, can you give us a real-life kind of example?
I mean, some examples that you will see that occur right now are you see nonprofits that have certain functions that they perform together. You can see hospitals, for example, that want to share laundry services may want to form a joint venture in order to do that. If they do it, they right now they either form it under the Minnesota Cooperative Corporations Act, or they would prefer to do it as a limited liability company because the operating strictures are less in that situation. And so you see them forming Delaware nonprofits to do that in a joint venture form. You will also see them if, we have, for example, in University Enterprise Laboratories is, a corporation, but it has a nonprofit limited liability company that operates in conjunction with it, which is a Delaware limited liability company because it could not form in Minnesota under the current Limited Liability Company Act. So those are a couple of situations where I have seen it. My partner practices more in the nonprofit area, and she would have seen more, but it is an issue among the nonprofit community.
Hmm. Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I haven't been on the tax committee for a while. I don't know if I see the immediate tax implication.
Yeah. Senator Scheid?
And nobody's contacted me, but that doesn't mean it isn't there.
It may be that I'm just asking questions out of my own ignorance, because it's an interesting concept. So, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Scheid. Question about the income. Are you saying that income and losses can then be transferred from the nonprofit to the limited liability company? Is that the approach?
You're asking me, Senator.
Or your testifier.
You to my expert here.
Mr. Klein.
Madam Chair, Senator. The income and loss of a limited liability company as a separate organization is its income and loss for state law purposes.
Right.
If it is to go anywhere, if the cash is to go anywhere, it has to make a distribution of that cash. And it would be subject to normal limited liability company rules that would require that its member or board authorize the distribution. And if it is a nonprofit, it would have to be a distribution to an entity that's entitled to receive a distribution from a nonprofit entity. We're distinguishing, I think, between income and loss in terms of cash flow and expense from accounting purposes versus income tax income and loss. And for that purpose, federal income tax law disregards the limited liability company, in essence, whose tax return that income would appear on. But the cash itself would be within the entity. Any distribution of that cash would be subject to its articles, bylaws, and the restrictions in law on who could receive distributions from an entity of that type.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, doesn't that change the law, sir, that then nonprofit corporations can then essentially distribute losses and earnings?
Well,
Mr. Klein.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe a nonprofit corporation right now can make distributions to other nonprofits. So if it is affiliated with another nonprofit corporation, it could, under law, make distributions of cash to that affiliate. I don't believe that this would change those rules.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, could the limited liability company that would now have this relationship with the nonprofit, could it then transfer income or assign income earnings or losses to individuals or other nonprofit entities?
Mr. Klein.
Madam Chair, Senator, the income and loss would be allocable for tax purposes to the owners. And the owners of a nonprofit limited liability company are limited in the statute, the proposed statute. So we would not have individuals that would be members that would be receiving allocations of income or loss for tax purposes. The cash itself, any distributions of cash, would be limited as well to the same extent as they are presently limited under 317A, the Nonprofit Corporation Act.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. But the members that can receive the distribution of either loss or gain can be for-profit entities.
Mr. Klein.
They could receive for tax purposes. Let me take a look back at the statute here. The statute would not prohibit that. It would prohibit any individual from owning that. But again, Madam Chair, Senator, the income or loss allocation for federal income tax purposes would be different from the allocation or distribution of any proceeds. No cash could go to any person that was not a nonprofit entity.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, just a comment for the committee. That's one of the concerns I have had with this whole concept of nonprofit corporations or not-for-profit entities. The whole concept is that we are not going to transfer the wealth or the losses and give someone who's a private entity a benefit from that. That's not the purpose of having a nonprofit corporation, and it sounds to me like this actually goes around that. Now, whether the other members of this committee agree with my concern or not, it definitely is one that I have raised in the tax committee before, that we give an awful lot of support to nonprofit and we provide them an awful lot of status that we don't give to other legal entities. And I think there's a perception that nonprofit corporations are exactly that, and that they are not passing along income and loss to for-profit entities. And it, when they do that, I think that we start to lose the credibility and the understanding of what a not-for-profit organization is.
Well, and you know, Senator Schott, I think you want to take on the perception question.
Madam Chair, yes, and Mr. Knorr would like.
Mr. Knorr.
Madam Chair, Senator, the permitting entities to form nonprofit LLCs, you know, these nonprofit LLCs will be governed by the same restrictions as nonprofit corporations are. So the to the extent a nonprofit corporation could make a distribution to an entity that owned it, so could an LLC, but not, you know, a nonprofit LLC would lose its tax-exempt status if it made distributions to parties that were not 501c3 qualified type of entities. And so the proposed act does not, all it does is import LLCs into the nonprofit, the existing nonprofit framework, if you will. It does not provide any other opportunity to make distributions to people who would not be able to get distributions from nonprofit corporations.
Nonprofits get the advantage of organizing under LLC. LLC does not get the advantage of automatically getting the nonprofit because they basically get the nonprofit status imposed on them and the nonprofit LLC, right?
Madam Chair, the process would be either for a corporation or an LLC would be formed at the state level, and then an application would be made to the IRS for tax-exempt status is how nonprofits usually do it. And the right now, you cannot file – your application would be refused by the IRS because of the limitations in Minnesota under the LLC Act, although you could do it with a corporation still.
Interesting. Senator Scheid? Senator Orman, did you have a follow-up? Senator Orman?
What would be the impetus? I mean, what is driving this change? I'm trying to understand why we need to combine LLC status with nonprofit corporate status.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Ms. Knorr.
The impetus behind this proposed legislation is a response to the practical reality that nonprofit entities in Minnesota are setting up Delaware LLCs so that they can keep them in the nonprofit sphere. And what this act actually does, I believe, is it actually then, if they were to do that in Minnesota, it would at least give the Attorney General's office some oversight ability over these entities that right now are being formed in Delaware, not allowed to qualify and register here, so there's not even information on them. And at least now the Attorney General's office will get filings for them, and they will have the oversight that they do not have now. That is one of the goals of this legislation.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Klein.
Senator, there's also one other aspect to that, and that, you know, we are aware that Minnesota nonprofits are forming single-member Minnesota limited liability companies, relying on the flow-through status for federal income tax purposes, yet they are doing so in many cases without adequate counsel, and they don't understand that, in fact, the IRS would view that entity as not having being consistent with their tax-exempt purpose. So we do have a situation right now where you have nonprofits that have adequate counsel are going to Delaware and they're doing this. Those that aren't fully vetting the process are forming a Minnesota limited liability company with who knows what consequences later. So there's a trap for the unwary there that we think also should be addressed.
I have a question about an earlier section on page 2, lines 1 through 4, when we talk about depositing the notice. Can you, Mr. Knorr, can you talk with us a little bit more about that? What is the current practice, and what does this new language add to that?
Madam Chair, the current language of the statute would require, would provide that notice is effective only when the FedEx package arrives, when it's
at the home of the recipient.
Correct. This language is intended to make a FedEx delivery, for example, consistent with the process of delivery through U.S. mail, which is when you put it in the U.S. mailbox, it is considered delivered. And that's the intent is that that would be the same process in for one of these nationally recognized overnight delivery system services.
That's what I thought. You know, I had Professor Matheson in law school. And then on page 11, section 13, I just had a question. Maybe I missed it. We're talking about the telephonic transmission. And under current law, do we require any kind of proof of that, or how do we I just don't know enough about this area. So what is the evidence if we do telephonic or electronic communications? Are we required to retain something to show that the communication actually did take place?
Madam Chair, the last sentence of the language is intended to address that specific question. You know, it's the requirement would be that this telephonic transmission, the fax, if you will, must be submitted with information from which it can be determined that it was authorized by the shareholder. So that would need to be, you know, a signature, for example, of the shareholder, electronic signature on an email would suffice as well.
But we say that, but we don't specify that, because I'm assuming that in the trade they have ways of doing that.
Madam Chair, the statute does not specify, and the reason it doesn't is because we did not want to limit, you know, the moment you put in a statute, the way to do things, other ways that are used in the trade, you know, automatically become invalid, and that was not the intent.
Mr. Klein and Mr. Knorr and Senator Scheid, are there people who are going to have heartburn over this that are not here today or we don't know of? Has anybody contacted you?
Madam Chair, nobody has contacted me. These gentlemen may know.
Madam Chair, we have discussed this with the Secretary of State's office, and I understand Secretary Ritchie is strongly in support of this. We have also had discussions with representatives of the Attorney General's office, and we have made changes to the proposed statute in response to those meetings, and those were submitted to the Attorney General's office in the last quarter, I think, of 2007.
Okay. Any other questions for Senator Scheid or two witnesses on the bill? Senator Scheid, what is your desire?
Yes, Madam Chair, my desire is that I would move that Senate File 2575 as amended be recommended to pass.
Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you.
Mr. Knorr, Mr. Klein, thank you for coming in. You've done good work. Every chief author wants their people to do this kind of work.
You got that right.
Members, we were set to restart, I believe, at 6:30 to look at the bridge claims bill. I hope that you will try to make it back in a timely manner so that we can get going. We're just going to recess, but I hope that we can process that so that we can get you all out of here early. So the committee stands in recess.
Are these the bills that are-